Well, congratulations on a wonderful new Rachmaninoff release. We're speaking with Leonard Slatkin, and I was curious, this is such lush, wonderful music, and yet I think it speaks in our time quite well, or perhaps we need this sort of music. How is it to record these two works?
30 years ago, I recorded all the Rachmaninoff symphonies with my then orchestra, St. Louis, and returning to these scores and re-examining them, you're right. There is a change in the way we perceive this particular music. In the 80s, it was very anachronistic. There was very little acceptance of the sort of romantic vein that we saw this style of music being presented. It somehow felt out of sorts with the time. But now, in the 21st century, it seems fresh and almost modern in ways, perhaps because we don't hear this sound or this style so often. It was a lot of fun to put back together and to rethink these various pieces of music. I enjoyed it immensely, and I think you can tell from the orchestra's performances that they threw themselves into them wholeheartedly.
These are not only romantic, but these are very late Rachmaninoff, which I think we know the piano concertos and, the Second Symphony is certainly there. But these, to me, are even sort of quintessential, even more caricatures of Rachmaninoff at that ultimate high point.
Well, of course, by this time, he's become a resident in the United States. And this has influenced his writing tremendously, in particular with how he uses the orchestra. If you go to those concertos you were talking about, or the Second Symphony, these are products of the late Russian Romantic school, very much in line with Tchaikovsky, or even in some cases, Rimsky-Korsakov. But by the time we get to the Third Symphony and the Symphonic Dances, what we're looking at is a composer in full command of his orchestral resource. We have to remember that Rachmaninoff was also, in addition to being a composer and pianist, a well-respected conductor. He knew his way around the orchestra. And even though the roots of these pieces is very much part of the Russian Romantic tradition, the orchestration is very much part of the 20th century.
He's one of these people that we do have recordings of him, and we do have pictures and letters. There was, all this sort of thing. I remember being touched that he wanted to do something because he wanted to buy a car. Automobiles were fairly new, and he was out of Russia and wanted to do a project because he thought, oh yeah, I can afford to get an automobile. When you return to a score like this after 30 years, are there extra musical things, or is it things that you want to go back and find in a manuscript? How did you prepare this new recording?
I think in general, my whole approach to almost every composer has changed and evolved over the years. I didn't really go back and listen to what I did 30 years ago. That just didn't seem right. So I tried to approach these pieces in a fresh way. It's not that I haven't done them for 30 years. It's that I hadn't recorded it in 30 years. And I would say that probably if there's one aspect that's the most different for me, it's being able to sustain a longer line. In other words, I think probably the earlier versions are perhaps more detail-oriented, and the later renditions for me are more concerned about getting from the beginning to the ending in one cohesive whole.
As you work with the Detroit Symphony and getting to know them and sort of getting that sort of recording down, I imagine going through this wonderful festival that you did with the 9 Beethoven symphonies certainly lets you all sort of explore music and interpretation a lot.
I'm not a fan, usually, of settling down to one composer for such a long period of time. It was 3 weeks to do all 9 symphonies. But in this case, it proved more than beneficial for many reasons, one of which is that there was a unanimity of approach in viewing all the symphonies. Now I began to see them in their context in relation to each other, as opposed to a more traditional programming where you might have a Beethoven symphony paired with, say, a contemporary piano concerto and a maybe a romantic overture. Now each piece was looked upon in terms of how it felt in relationship to the pieces that came before and after. It also gave us a chance over a 3-week span to actually focus on this one style. So you begin to hear similarities, even between the First and the Ninth Symphony. The fact that we were recording them for digital download purposes, really didn't enter into it. It just happened that we thought that was a good idea, and it was an opportunity for our audiences to hear the Detroit Symphony in this most important body of works as presented over a very short time span.
Is this a new way of sort of not only sharing the orchestra, but I know, you know, there was a bad year, you know, where you guys weren't playing. Is this sort of a road to recovery and maybe a new direction with the, you know, sort of streaming and now this sort of digital download that's happening?
It's very much part of that. One of the things that we worked on all during that strike, which was six months we did not play, was how do we recover from this? What's not just our exit strategy, but what's our strategy moving forward? And among the discussions, both with the board, the management, and the musicians, was the idea to make the orchestra, as our public relations department likes to call it, the most accessible orchestra on the planet. I'm not sure about that marketing scheme, but it seems to be working. And the ways we do it are to reach a broad audience via the streaming of our subscription concerts. Virtually every one is presented as a video presentation live and then usually rebroadcast. So that means for 21 weeks out of the season, people all over the world can not only hear the orchestra, they can see the orchestra. Releasing and continuing to release albums of music, I think, is still viable, maybe for another 4 or 5 years. But the market is moving different directions, and that's why we opted for this digital download with the Beethoven symphonies. It's a relatively new concept for orchestras, but we're constantly trying to think of different ways, novel ways, and ways that will embrace the technology of our time in order to present what it is that we do.
Well, it's certainly lovely to hear. I think being able to see and for young people who maybe are using technology even more, and some of us middle-aged folks that are certainly happy to pull it up on our iPad or our computer.
That's true. But we also, of course, are not neglecting our live audience. And in order to accomplish the goal of filling our auditorium, which is one of the great halls in the world, actually, Orchestra Hall, we offer for students something called the Sound Card. For $25, you buy this credit card size thing 2 weeks before any performance in the hall, whether it's the orchestra or whether it's a jazz event or whatever we're presenting. If there are tickets available, present the card and you're in. But that's $25 for the whole year, not per event. So people really have the opportunity to hear a wide variety of music live. And it's working because we've sold over 1,500 of these sound cards. And when you look at the audience, either as we're streaming the concerts or if you attend, what you see is a much more riotous looking audience than you see in many, many auditoriums around the world.
Oh, excellent. That's very exciting.
We also play concerts in our suburbs now. We in Detroit have suburbs that are in some cases 45, 50 minutes away. As people know, Detroit has been a major market for exodus starting from 1968. And like most communities, the majority of our audience lives in the suburban area, many of whom don't want to come downtown, many of whom are not able to come downtown. So we decided to go out to those communities. We play 6 different venues in 4 different packages of concerts. In other words, each suburb gets a series of 4 concerts. Each one is on a subscription basis, and we've increased our subscription audience by 2,500 people simply by playing in the suburbs.
We're speaking with Leonard Slatkin, the music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. You're preparing to do all 4 Ives symphonies. One, I don't know that that's ever been done. I hope it has, but if not,
no,
I think it's
the
pretty
first
awesome.
First time it's been done live. And maybe the last. Who knows?
Well, is there, I mean, this is sort of a marathon. If I were to think of, you know, huge pieces of music, especially for the conductor, I mean, other than, you know, trying to do the Mahler symphonies, I think the 4 Ives symphonies are musically and there's probably been a lot of prep for you.
It is a challenge, but think about it. You could certainly do the 4 Brahms symphonies and no one would raise an eyebrow. Or you could do the 4 Schumann symphonies. And again, there would be, oh, that's okay. But the Ives symphonies present a whole other set of challenges. First of all, the music is not so familiar. And the second thing is, more than any composer I can think of, you span not only his musical growth, but literally the coming of age of American music with these four symphonies, starting with the first, which basically has no Americanisms at all. It sounds like Dvorak, it sounds like Brahms, it sounds like Wagner. It certainly doesn't sound like Ives, and it has little of the hymn tunes, patriotic melodies, folk songs that Ives would use in his later symphonies. Then you get to the second symphony, where for the first time we see Columbia, the Gem of the Ocean, America the Beautiful, a few other songs that people know, being incorporated into the overall symphonic structure. Then you come to the third symphony, where Ives begins to really experiment with those famous wrong notes, which sort of pop up in the second symphony, but now are much more present, and the dissonance is a little more harsh than we've had before. And finally, to the fourth symphony, which is unlike any other music that had been written at the time. It's important to realize that the symphony was completed in 1916, just 3 years after the Rite of Spring. And there's no way Ives could have heard the Rite of Spring at that point. And yet this music is so far advanced, so far in a world of its own, that it's virtually impossible to compare it to anything that had occurred before. So the four symphonies really give us a chance to understand how the composer began and how he wound up.
Yeah, we're very much looking forward to these because you will hear one of them occasionally, but not very often. But to be able to hear these all four at one point, I think will be exciting.
Yeah, as I say, it's not really meant as a stunt. It's meant as a true journey to understand how Ives became who he was.
It's not that one might take one composer like this, but I'm sure it's been interesting to find this sort of journey. I mean, we know, you know, the premieres were far later.
Yes, in the case of the fourth, more than 50 years, and a little bit less, but the same idea with the second symphony. I think for me, what's been astonishing in going through these is I look back. I was at the premiere of the Fourth Symphony in 1965. I sat in the Carnegie Hall audience, and I hated it. I really didn't like it at all. I didn't understand it. I had no clue as to what was going on. It just seemed like a jumble of sound and just not worth the 35 minutes it took. Now, over the course of the years, my attitude about Ives has radically altered. And to sit down with the four symphonies and view them and try to place Ives in this most important of positions, literally being the first composer to create American music for the concert hall, is quite daunting. But you begin to see how he evolved, what his roots were, and where he would lead this country musically.
And it's got to be pretty special that it's, again, at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. When you think that the second and the fourth were both premiered in that hall, that makes it very impressive. The first is, of course, a rarity. You really don't hear it very often. And the third, probably you hear a little more, but still, you're right. These symphonies are not yet part of the musical mainstream. And maybe Ives isn't meant to be that way. Maybe he's such a special case that it should be reserved for unique occasions.
It's so nice to talk with you, Leonard. We hope the concerts are going to go well. Our listeners, I know, are going to enjoy it, being able to see them on a webcast and whatnot.
And actually, I'll be down in the Texas area in a few weeks because I'm the conductor this year for the Van Cliburn competition.
Not
near here, but I'll be at least in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, no doubt. I guess I'd end asking, we were all pretty saddened about Janusz Starker and the news of his passing. And I thought it was, I thought yesterday, listening to Dvorak, you know, what a special person he was.
Yes, and Lynn and I were talking, and Lynn said that the first recording he ever owned was Starker playing the Dvorak. And I was privileged enough to have the chance to record the work with Janusz, as well as Don Quixote with him, the Elgar Concerto, the Walton Concerto. He was an amazing figure, most important figure in music. I always suggest with him, if you really want to get a sense of the true artistry of the man, there are two ways. One, listen to his recording of the Bach suites, at least the first recording. But even more so, his incredible performances of the Kodály unaccompanied cello sonata. This really shows you supreme mastery of the instrument of musicality. And I guess it's also important to remember he was among the most important cello teachers that we had in this country. He spent most of his time teaching at Indiana University, where I'm sure everyone is still very sad today.
Yeah. Thanks so much. We appreciate it. We're looking forward to even more. Are there any projects you can share that are on the horizon?
Oh, of course. We always have projects. Actually, the Carnegie Hall trip, the Ives program, is preceded the night before by another performance with the Detroit Symphony in Carnegie Hall. We have music of Rachmaninoff with the Caprice Bohemian and Isle of the Dead, which I find very interesting because we hear one piece where Rachmaninoff is early and very much under the spell of Rimsky, and then Isle of the Dead, which to me is actually the greatest work he wrote in my mind. And then we have a performance of Kurt Weill's Seven Deadly Sins featuring the singer Storm Large. May not be so familiar a name to everybody. She was a big indie rock performer and has now moved over to cabaret-style singing. She also works frequently with Pink Martini. So she's quite a character, and it should be extraordinary. Then I have another orchestra, which is the Orchestre National de Lyon, the National Symphony of Lyon, which is in France. And we've also been busy in the recording studios. We are about halfway through a project of recording every note Ravel wrote for orchestra, including works that were orchestrated by others of his piano music. And that eventually will be, I think, 10 CDs. We're also recording a great deal of Berlioz with this orchestra. And between Detroit and Lyon, I have to say my musical life is very full, and all the other engagements I accept and take are just icing on the cake. I'm having, at this point in my life and at 68 years old, I'm having just a great time.
Oh, excellent. Well, all my friends on Facebook were jealous I got to speak with you today and send their regards.
Tell them thank you, and they should all check out the Detroit Symphony website because that connects you to all the music we're doing, and you'll be able to see us again, I guess, in 3 weeks when we're back with a live performance with myself and my orchestra. But as you pointed out, everybody can listen to the Carnegie Hall programs. They'll be on the internet. So
yeah.
Do tune in. Your only chance probably ever to hear all four symphonies of Charles Ives live.
Yeah. Well, toi toi, and thanks so much.
Thank you. You take care.